And Christianity and Islam, you all have, I presume, received the folder on this, which tells you about these three scholars who have honored us with their presence. And so I will simply point them out to you. The first gentleman over on my left here is, on the far end, is Dr. Greg Bonson, who represents a scholarly approach to Christianity. The man in the middle is our representative for Islam and is a world traveler, as most of you have read about him, and is also the head of the local group in Orange County and serves on many committees. This is Mr. Sadecki and Dr. Sadecki, and then our representative of the Jewish faith, which is Rabbi Daniel Landis. Now, I presume that most of you have heard them last evening, and our panel over here has heard them. And so represented on our panel are three people in these particular fields. On my far right is Sonia Efron, who is a reporter for the LA Times and who has just returned from Kuwait. And I don't know what significance that has in terms of our questioning, but maybe it'll bring up some interesting things for us. Next to her is the assistant professor of philosophy, and this year he is teaching for the first time in religious studies a course on the philosophy of religion, Dr. Gain Aniker. And seated closest to me here is a professor, the associate professor of English and technical writing, and most of you see him on campus, Don Pierstorff. And I'm Ted Wall, who represents a moderating position here. And I am teaching in Orange Coast now for over 22 years, religious studies and philosophy. And many of the audience are my students, have been my students. We will be interested to see what happens this afternoon. Now, our approach to this particular panel discussion is that each one of these representatives here will have 3 to 5 minutes to state a summary of anything they want to talk about that happened last night. And then they have a chance to pick one of the scholars over here and ask him a question, and then he has 3 to 5 minutes to answer that question. And so we'd like to get a question then later from the audience, so we hope that this will move along smoothly. And if anybody runs over time, I will use my heavy hand and loud voice and shout them down. Now, you all know that and you are here because you are interested in religion, and obviously religion is everywhere. And all of these men and women here realize the truth of St. Augustine's remark that our hearts are restless until they find their rest in Thee, O God. And of course, people from the Orient can follow this very easily. But here we're talking about three groups that represent a belief in the supernatural. And this is the distinguishing characteristics of these three religions. Now, where they vary is what you're going to hear about today. And I hope you don't think this is twiddly-dee and twiddly-dum, but that there are actually some differences of significance between these three groups. So now, to move right along, we're going to ask Sonia Efron to be our first representative to review some material and ask the question.
Well, I'm here today as a representative of the Fourth Estate, not as a religious scholar. And the media usually avoids, like the plague, getting involved in these kinds of religious discussions. So, although we're not as objective about these subjects as we'd like to think we are. But today, I think as a full disclosure, I should tell you that I'm probably also here as a representative of the secular humanist movement, the fourth credo, I suppose. And in that context, I'd like to ask you some questions that are perhaps a bit more political.
all of you have been having the arguments that we went over last night for about 13 centuries, and last night's dialogue was, of course, much more cordial than it's usually been, and I think that's a very positive step. I'm also pleased to be here today while Secretary of State Baker is putting the finishing touches on the Middle East Peace Conference, and I think that's also a very encouraging step. But at last count, we had about, I think the count was 86 different tribal, religious, ethnic, and other wars going on the planet. So in that context, I'd like to ask you, first of all, and this question I think I've asked first for Dr. Benson, given that there's so much political and civil conflict, not just among your few faiths, but elsewhere, what responsibility do you feel that Christians have toward unbelievers, towards people of different faiths, and towards those who don't share any of the basic Judeo-Christian Islamic tenets? And also, do you recognize that there can be such a thing as secular morality?
From a Christian standpoint, we do not, if we understand the gospel correctly, we do not believe we have any position of privilege or advantage over other individuals. I'm afraid the clarity and conviction with which the gospel is sometimes preached is taken by people as an assertiveness and arrogance or pride decision. We are the blessed possessors and no one else has anything to offer to any discussions and so forth. And I'm sorry when that impression is given. I don't want to give up the confidence with which we understand the gospel, mind you. But it's important for us as Christians to know that what we do have, the blessing that we do have, is a blessing of God's grace. We hear this expression bantered about even in secular ways, there but for the grace of God go I. And it's banal now maybe to use that, but from a Christian perspective that's very true. When I look at my colleagues here seated on the right, I don't look upon them as somehow inferior to me as an individual. And what I have in the gospel, if it be true, I believe with all my heart it is, but what I have in the gospel is not because I somehow have earned a better privilege in the sight of God, or I have come before him in a way that is more acceptable, and so he has honored me, and so forth. It is purely a gift of God's grace. For by grace are you saved through faith, Paul says. That's not of yourselves. It's a gift of God. So our responsibility to those who do not have that faith is the responsibility of someone who enjoys a great privilege, has a great blessing, that wants it shared with others. When we get into debate, often it looks like we're beating on each other, maybe intellectually. But in the end, what we want to do is to share a gift, the gift that God himself has given us. You asked a second question about the possibility of secular morality. And we may want to touch you and me sometime, either here or elsewhere, about that as you represent the fourth option before the audience today. One of the areas of my philosophical specialization, which doesn't make me right or wrong, but hopefully makes me more informed, is the question of ethics. And it is my own conviction that to the degree that secularists portray any absolutes in morality, they are really borrowing from other worldviews, and particularly, I would think, borrowing from the revelation of God that is found in the natural world round about them. You can't come into this world without knowing God. This is my conviction. It's taught by Paul in Romans 1. He made you in his image. He is constantly revealing himself through the grandeur of the creation round about. And therefore, in your heart of hearts, you do know that it's wrong to murder, to lie, to steal, and so forth. So I don't deny for a moment that unbelievers, in the broadest sense, practice an ethic. They're vociferous often in their ethics, against war or against the Supreme Court nominee or whatever it may be. They have very strong opinions in ethics. But I would argue that though they practice ethics, they cannot account for ethics, and in the end, their ethics disintegrates under philosophical analysis. Because without the absolute of God's holy character behind ethics, it eventually becomes a matter of every man for himself. You see it one way, I see it another. Surely, if you don't believe in the doctrine of creation and you have a naturalistic understanding of the human creature, you know, you believe that the opinions that you come up with are the result of electrochemical stimulus in the mind and so forth, I don't see that you can philosophically ground an ethical perspective on that. You can't come up with the oughtness of ethics just from a description of man's natural existence. And so, though I don't deny that my unbelieving friends attempt to practice ethics, I would philosophically argue they have no foundation for it.
All right, thank you very much. Now, let's move on to Dr. Gayne Anneker.
Okay, thank you. I was impressed last night that all the panelists are affirming the concept of religious tolerance, which has as a minimal notion forswearing of force or conversion, and which has also as a minimal notion of committing of different religious practices within a given area. And I would also say that all the panelists moved on to affirm something even more, that arising out of each one's religion was a duty not only to forswear force, but also to promote a sense of dignified relations between the religions and a sense of respect and brotherly, sisterly feeling among peoples of different religions. And that's, I think it's important to notice that that's more than just religious tolerance, but that's a positive relationship between people, which is, I think, excellent. Another commonality between the religions, which is outstanding, I think, and which Dr. Bonson touched on, is that they share a common moral outlook based in large measure on the common book, which they share, and the traditions that arise out of that common authoritative document. And interestingly enough, all the religions assert that the practice of that common moral outlook begins in and proceeds out of humility before God. That is, that the truly religious member of each of the religions begins by being a humble creature before God, and that humility before God leads to a dignity of treatment for the others. And so I applaud that commonality. And that's something to be built on. I have some specific questions now that I hope to try to determine a little more distinct, sharpened disagreements between the religions here. So if you'll permit me to try to get at some distinctions. I have a question for Rabbi Landis on this. Rabbi Landis spoke about the Jews as the chosen people, and I, as a Christian, take the notion of the Jews as a chosen people very seriously, and I don't at all diminish the idea, and I have some understanding of what he means by that concept. He said at the time last night that being a chosen people means at least this: the Jews are, as a result of this, to stand at the center of humanity between the spirit and the material. And it seems to imply that the chosenness of his people is something of a unique relationship with God, and especially unique relationship. And I think I understand that, and I have no quarrel with that. At another point, however, later on in the evening, Rabbi Landis, he said that he said that being the chosen people of God does not mean that God cannot reveal himself to or deal with other peoples in other nations via other religions, apparently in a religiously adequate sense. And what I would ask you is, if that latter is the case, if God can and does adequately deal with and reveal himself to other peoples and other nations through other religions, in what sense then is it meant that the Jews are a chosen people? And in what sense is this a unique and especially unique relationship with God?
You always take notes? Don't tell my wife. She'll let out do it also. I think it's like this. I think
I think what's crucial is the difference between conversion and influence. The fact that Jews seek no converts, and Jews feel, in a very real sense, that other religions may be adequate for other groups. In the real sense, I mean, in a non-patronizing sense, does not mean that we want to give up influence. It doesn't mean that we have a feeling that there are certain aspects of our faith understanding which would be quite beneficial to other groups. And therefore, we do seek to influence. And the influence can go in several different arenas. Let me give an example. The fact that good works are crucial for a religion is something which Judaism would like to impress upon others. That is a polemical point. That is something that we want to evangelicize in a certain sense. Or the notion that one can come to God directly without the need of an intermediary, without the need of complex ways of buffers between the individual and God. This is something we'd also like to influence the other religions. And so therefore, our sense is that we have a peculiar and particular destiny. We have a ways of working things out. But our particular symbols and our particular ways of working out might not be those that are necessarily needed to be accepted by others. We don't need others to necessarily have a Passover ritual. But the sense of liberation, the need for liberation, is something we do want to impress upon. We don't need others to lament the destruction of our temple, or for that matter, even the destruction within the Holocaust, but we feel a need to impress upon others the fragility of life. So I would say that in a certain sense, we are out there, we do intend to seek an effect, but it's not an effect of absorption. And let me add something to it. The danger, of course, is the lack of humility, which is always a personal difficulty that I have. But it's always a problem when you're out there teaching. And I could make certain ideas of selflessness, and I could possibly say that we don't feel arrogant at all. I think there's a tremendous striving within Judaism not to be arrogant. But nonetheless, we do put ourselves often in the pedagogic position. And as all of you know, that you put yourself in a pedagogic position, that's one of the occupational hazards. So, next slide.
All right, Don Pierstorf. Now you have your presentation and your question.
I left last night knowing more than when I came. And today, I already learned something. It's the first time that Dr. Aniker and I have ever agreed on anything. Subtitles to say the same. The subtitle of this two-day discussion was Sister Faith in Conflict. And after last night, I decided that that shouldn't be subtitled that way. I don't believe it was or is now a matter of sister faith. I think you're more like cousins. I'm from a very large family in Kentucky, and we used to have reunions and all these Pierstorfs and the Myers and the Kermans in a large field, and they would throw up tents, three large tents, and all the Pierstorfs were in this tent, and the Myers were over there, and the Kermans were over there, and they pretended to be related. They didn't talk to each other at all unless there was money or land involved, and I think that's where we are right now today. So I represent the very few of you who are as ignorant as I am, and I know there's only a few of you, but have faith because I'm here. The major thing that I learned, in addition to that, and this charge with Aniker, is that, seriously, the one thing I did learn, and I'll die knowing, is every religion is superior to the people who practice it. that I came away to learn. The other thing I learned is that the Jews and the Muslims seem to me, as a result of last night, to be a lot closer than the Christians are to the Jews, or the Jews are to the Christians, or the Muslims are to the Christians are to the Jews. In one major respect, if I'm wrong, I know that Dr. Siddiqui and Rabbi Landis will correct me. After what Rabbi Landis just said, I'm positive he will correct me. The Jews and the Muslims don't separate religion, politics, economics, jurisprudence. That's all one big integral part of the religion as I see it from based on last night's conversation. And from what Dr. Bonson said, I saw that too, and render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and unto God that which is God, seems to me to indicate that as well. But you'll notice, if you were here last night, Dr. Siddiqui and Rabbi Landis talked a great deal about religion, and while they were talking about religion, they included as part of their religious discussion Jerusalem, Israel, Palestine, all of that, because that's part of their religion. They don't make that distinction that that's Israel and this is Judaism, or that's Palestine and this is Islam. They don't do that because, in my opinion, based on last night, they don't make those distinctions. This is all part of their religion. And that brings me to a question that I'd like to address Dr. Siddiqui, but I certainly would, if everything went well, I'd like to hear it from all three people, and that's a question, it's become a question, the question of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is important to the Muslims because of many reasons, but primarily, at least in my opinion, the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's certainly important to the Christians for many reasons, including the Church of the Holy Sepulcher. And my goodness, of course it's important to the Jews for many reasons, including the Wailing Wall. So, let me tell you what I want, and then I'll find out what I'm going to get. What I want is Jerusalem to be an open city governed by the United Nations mandate or some other way to keep it open, in some strange analogy like the Vatican. But I want to know from Dr. Siddiqui especially, in this order, and Rabbi Landis and Dr. Bob too, of course, what their opinion is about the current state of Palestine and what they think should be done about it, if anything. I'd like to start off, please, by addressing my question to Dr. Siddiqui.
Yep, 3 minutes. Well, let me say very quickly, there are a number of issues that are involved here. One of them is the issue of the people of Palestine, who are the inhabitants of the land, who've been living there for centuries and centuries, they and their forefathers and their forefathers. I think they do have a right to their land, regardless whether the other lands and other places exist or not in the Arab world. They do have a right to their homeland. And it is, they should live freely there and should govern themselves and should have all the rights that everybody in other parts of the world have those rights. And nobody is supposed to say that where they should go. It is their own choice where they want to live and how they want to live. And the second question is about what is the importance of the city of Jerusalem in Islam. And the city of Jerusalem is one of the holiest cities in Islam. A lot of people here, they understand the significance and the importance of the city of Jerusalem to Jews, and they also know the importance of the city of Jerusalem to Christians. But what my experience is that many Americans really don't fully understand and appreciate the importance of the city of Jerusalem to Muslims. To understand the importance of the city of Jerusalem for Muslims, you have to understand that David and Solomon are not Jewish prophets for us. David and Solomon are our prophets. And Moses and Jesus are our prophets. And Abraham is our prophet. And that history is our history from the Islamic point of view. It's as much as Christians claim the Old Testament as part of their Bible, Muslims also claim that land as part of their heritage because they believe in these prophets of God. And they have a great respect, and they have a great belief and faith. And that's why Prophet Muhammad was taken to the city of Jerusalem. And this is part of the Islamic understanding. That is, he went from Mecca to Jerusalem. and it was, and then from there he went to the heaven. It was not that there was no direct flight available from Mecca, but it is because to bring the Jerusalem and Mecca together, and Prophet Muhammad is the one who brings this thing, that is the whole understanding, the whole vision of Allah, the whole vision of the prophets of the Israel, this whole vision and the prophetic vision. So here the Ishmael and Isaac lying are brought together in Prophet Muhammad. So, and because of that, the city of Jerusalem has such an important place. So as soon as Muslims came in the year 638, the city was taken by Muslims without a war. In fact, Patriarch Sophronius is the one who opened the gates and offered the keys of the city of Jerusalem to the Caliph Umar, and he said that I'm going to give it to the Caliph, and Caliph came all the way on the camel from Medina to the city of Jerusalem in order to receive the keys of the city of Jerusalem from there. At that time, many of you may not know that the temple did not exist. It was already destroyed 5 centuries before, in the year 70 by the Romans. It did not exist. And the Christian administrators of that city, they did not build the temple. They did not feel a need of building the temple. In fact, it was a dunghill. They had no respect for that place. And when he was told that this is the place where the temple stood, he knelt down and he cleaned it by his own hand. He said, this is the sacred ground. While Umar, the Caliph, had to kneel down and say, this is the sacred ground, because of the feeling that this is the place of Solomon, this is the place of David, this is the place of the great prophets of God, and this is the place from where the prophet ascended to heaven. So it was that kind of an understanding. And then Patriarch Sophronius asked him that Jews should not be allowed to come into the city. We don't want them to be here, because you know, after the Romans, for centuries, Jews were excluded from the city of Jerusalem. And it was written in the covenant of Umar that Jews will be excluded from the city of Jerusalem. That was part of the term of the thing that he wanted to give the keys to the city because of that. But very soon Muslims realized that this is not a reasonable demand. This is not a logical demand, and they should come. And so the city was open to the Jewish population. They came, they established their Beth HaMidrash, they established their temple, they established their place of worship and learning, and they flourished. And when in the 11th century crusaders came and they took that city, again they did the same thing. They killed the inhabitants of the city, the Jewish inhabitants. They killed the Muslims. And again, the whole place, that sacred place, that was not used for worship. In fact, it was used as a stable. They kept their horses in that place. And for 90 years, that place remained that way. Then in 1187, Saladin comes and he takes over the city of Jerusalem from the crusaders and again purifies that place. It was washed. It was a Friday when the mosque was washed, and they brought the rose water and perfume and everything, and then after that the Friday prayer was held and the mosque was built in that place. And then again the city was open to the Jews to come and live there. And they were living there and they were flourishing there until the colonial times and all of those things happened. And you know, the Lord Allenby comes and he stands up at the grave of Saladin and said, today you have taken the revenge of Karakuri over Saladin. And then again the whole thing was started all over again to divide the Muslims and the Jews from each other. I think Muslims have lived with Christians and Jews very well, but it is the Western Christendom that did not want to see the two people live in peace. And if we can learn how to understand each other, how to understand our text, how to understand our history, it is possible that we can work together.
All right, thank you very much. Now, we're going to go back and let you start again. And Sonia, you may have another question.
Were we going to get a perspective from all three panelists on that last
question? Well, we'll give you a chance to do that. I think we want to make sure we have a chance to ask the three questions from the panelists. And at the end of that one, we'll go back to this more or less a political question.
I'm trying to understand the program.
Actually, I have a question I'd like to ask all three of you, but I'll start with Dr. Sylvie. I know, well, each of you last night discussed your view of man's covenant with God.
And none of you mentioned women, so I'd like to bring that up. As all of us know, each of your faiths is under pressure, both from outside, but primarily from inside, to grant equal status to women, both in the eyes of God, but also in the institutions of religion. So I'd like to ask you, first of all, Dr. Siddiqui, do you think, not the scriptures of Islam, but the institutions of the Islamic faith, do you think these institutions discriminate against women, and do you think they need to be changed?
There are things that are happening, let me say from the very beginning, there are things that are happening in the Muslim world, they do not all of them represent and reflect the true Islam. And there are a lot of improvement that is needed. And we have to go back to our scripture and we have to learn from that. And we have to learn from the example of the Prophet, peace be upon him. So I am not going to justify what is happening in Pakistan or what is happening in Egypt or what happens in some other places, that is what Islam is. And by the way, you don't do the same thing. What is happening in Los Angeles and Orange County is Christianity. You know that it is, there is, it's true that majority of the people are Christians, but not everything that happens in this area is on Christianity. And the same thing is also for Jewish people, they know that not every Jew is practicing Judaism. So it is the same way with the Muslim people. But at the same time, let me tell you that we do have certain moral positions which are different from the way that the Western world looks at this whole issue of genders. In Islam, it is recognized that both of them are equal in the sight of God. Both of them are, God had covenant with both of them, and there is no distinction. The Quran has spoken a great deal about that, but at the same time, we do believe that there is a distinct role that men and women play. And also Islam has a special standard for the society, for the morality. That is the illicit sex, the premarital sexual relations, and all those kind of things that go on, that is not what Islam wants. Now, it's good to speak about all that, and you know that last few days we've been hearing that hearing on the Jake Thomas and Anita Hill's statement. We are hearing that there are certain feelings, there are certain standards and values that people recognize. But at the same time, they do not know how to establish those values. There's a lot of contradiction that you can see. That is, in the office you cannot do it, but outside you can do it. All of these things, this is a contradiction. Islam doesn't want to establish that kind of a contradiction. The thesis of Islam is that there must be consistency in your life. Consistency in everything. It's not that under 18 cannot do it, after 18 you can do it. No, there is no such thing in Islam. It's not that certain areas are licensed for doing all those kind of things, but some other areas are not licensed for those things. This kind of licensing, that you can license immorality in some area, but you cannot in other areas. You can allow some people to do something, you cannot allow some other people to do. That Islamic standard is uniform standard for everyone. And for this thing, in order to keep this thing, Islam wants to see that there has to be, this is sexual drive, is a natural drive, and in fact it is something that is a gift of God. It is recognized. So that's why the Prophet said that the relation between the husband and wife is an act of worship. So it is to be taken in that kind of a sacredness, in that kind of sanctity should be given to that. And when it is to be given that kind of a sanctity, it will all come if the society is given certain rules of behavior, proper relations. Distance has to be recognized and observed, the proper dress that Islam speaks about. And what is the role that men will take, what is the role that women take, all of this should be understood in that broad context of morality and value. And that has to be observed, that has to be recognized. Unfortunately, with the onslaught of the Western culture, with the onslaught of the pornography, and America unfortunately is doing two things, exporting the arms to the whole world and exporting pornography to the whole world, it is that which is creating all the immorality in the world. And people use the word that this is modernity. It is not modernity. It is license.
Okay, thank you very much. Now, Dr. Anthony.
Yes, question for Rabbi Landis again. Nothing personal. I'd just like to hear from you at this point. Actually, this is a question I'll address to all the panelists, but I think it might be good to begin to a standard way of characterizing religion in general is that there's especially monotheistic religions, is that there's a conception that there's some kind of gulf or a gap between God and man, and that in a sense the faith and practice of a religion is some sort of means of bridging that gulf or gap and permitting the human being to stand within the presence of God in some sense. One could argue that that's a standard view of understanding religions. Now, my question is just this. Within Judaism, what do you mean by affirming that God is holy? How do you affirm that? What kind of ideas do you use, stories, metaphors, perhaps? What does it mean to say that God is holy? And then the next question is, what is it within the faith or the practice of Judaism which serves as the means by which the human being comes to stand before standing God's presence?
The word holy in Hebrew is kadosh. Kadosh means absolutely separate. And therefore the gulf becomes totally understood, because when one stands before the one who is utterly separate, utterly transcendent, how does one overcome that gulf? The only way to overcome that gulf, according to Judaism, is for the person herself to become holy. For the person herself to achieve a certain measure of transcendence. The primary techniques of Judaism would be the following. The first technique is that of restriction, saying no, turning off, tuning out, to use some metaphors from the past. That explains all the biblical prohibitions as understood by the rabbis, dietary restrictions, restrictions in terms of sexuality, restrictions in terms of economic activities, restrictions of the Sabbath laws. That one does not always have to feel that one has to participate within everything within the world. That one could stand back and say no. I think that's, by the way, the first point of maturity when you raise children, by the way, is the ability not for you to say no to them, but for them to say no, whether it's towards the television or whether it's to a snack at the wrong time. And in terms of religious element, that's saying no, and one then one becomes themselves partially holy, one has become separate. The second technique of Judaism is participation in a holy cause. And the holy cause, we understand, is the mitzvah, the commandment, just the moral act. One does that which is the yes, but the yes now in the proper direction. When one could say no, as an example in the sexual realm, when one says no to an extramarital affair, when one says no to your own desire when your spouse is really not in the mood, when one says no when things are inappropriate, then later on when one is able to say yes, the yes can be a very holy yes. The notion, therefore, of Judaism and holiness and bridging the gap is the ability to restrain oneself in order to store up the power to say yes, and then to say yes in a fully integrated experience.
Okay. Don? I think the reason I want to ask Rabbi Landis another question, is that he's an extraordinary speaker, and all three of these people have something I'll never have, and that magnificent total dedication. Last night, I took notes too, Rabbi. Last night, Rabbi Landis said that the Jews believe that the humans have, that all humanity have dignity, and it's Jewish responsibility to create dignity for others. I think that's a marvelous statement. And added that to be human is not to be absolute. I'd like Rabbi Landis to comment, please, on the one sentence that I'm going to read. This is not one of those terrible questions that goes on 13 days. This was written by a rabbi who was also a member of the Knesset. The non-Jew has no share in the land of Israel. He has no ownership, citizenship, destiny in it. That's leading up to the sentence. The non-Jew in Israel must accept basic human obligations, then he may live in Israel as a resident stranger, but never as a citizen with any proprietary interest or with any political say, never as one who can hold any public office that will give him dominion over a Jew or share in the authority of the country. I find that in mild conflict, as I say, I'm not Jewish, I find it in conflict with what Rabbi Landis mentioned last night, and I know it's my fault, I'd just like to reconcile that, if I may.
Let me answer two questions. Let me first answer that question within my 3 minutes. I reject that statement. You're not quoting me, right? I reject.
As a matter of fact.
No. I reject. I reject it. But let me say the following: the one country, the one place where Jews have a say of their own destiny is the state of Israel. It is the only spot on earth where we have that possibility. Within the Knesset, any member of any faith, anyone who lives within the state of Israel, can be elected to a party. There are Arab representatives, there are Christian representatives, there are Arab Christian representatives, there are Jews who believe in Judaism, there are Jews who don't believe in Judaism, Jews who reject Judaism within that. The only measure that I would place within a person having a share within the state of Israel is the ability to affirm the law of the state of Israel. I think that's a fair measure of citizenship. And therefore, for example, the fact that a person, in order to be a representative, takes an oath to uphold the institutions of the United States, I would say, in a practical sense, I would demand the same thing of anybody within the state of Israel. A person that was seditious or was treasonous, they have to say the same thing. Therefore, by the way, 3 years ago, the Israeli government banned an ultra-right-wing Jewish party called Kaf for that very reason. Because it was seditious, in a sense, that it had ultra-nationalistic desires coming from the Jewish experience, coming from Jewish sources, but did not agree to the law of the state of Israel. And therefore, I would just say the same thing. I mean, that's a legalistic answer, but it's actually the question that you're, as far as part of the question asked. If I have to say something else, let me just throw this out. And that is, dignity goes in many different directions. And therefore, I think any movement towards greater dignity that accepts upon itself at the same time responsibility is a profoundly religious movement. And therefore, I find it to be profoundly religious or religiously significant because it affirms human dignity, as long as it also, at the same time, affirms the responsibility that must go in its wake. And I see this also in terms of other nationalisms.
Okay, thank you. Now, Dr. Bronson, we didn't give you a chance on the other question, which is similar to this one in some ways. So now, can you help us out with your attitude toward this making the city of Jerusalem an international community under the sponsorship of the UN?
I don't think I have personally any wisdom that might be added, but I do think the Bible speaks to that, and if I might offer an interpretation that I hope will be challenging, it will at least give us another option to think through. From a Christian perspective, the promise made by God in the Old Testament to Abraham of a land was to be seen as God's promise of part for whole. That is to say, the land was to be a small microcosm of what God wished to do in the entire world. It was, if you will, a picture of his kingdom, which was not intended to be restricted to the land of Palestine. Paul reflects on that in Romans 4th chapter, verse 13, where he recites the promise God made to Abraham, and we might say, from a technical standpoint, gets it wrong, because this isn't what God said to Abraham, but Paul says the promise was made to Abraham that he would be heir of the world. Heir of the world? Well, heir of Palestine, perhaps, but not heir of the world, except that from the Christian perspective, what God was doing there was a pedagogical symbol of what he was intending to do for all mankind in establishing his kingdom on earth. In John, the 4th chapter, verses 20 to 23, we read, therefore, that when the Messiah came, Jesus one day spoke to a woman at a well in Samaria. And it's fascinating insight to human psyche. She, knowing that he was a prophet, is very nervous. And so instead of answering his question, she tries to change the subject to theological debate. You see people do that all the time. She goes, well, now, of course, we have, you Jews, you say you're supposed to worship in Jerusalem, but we Sumerians, we think we're supposed to worship here in this hill. And so what do you make of this, Jesus? And Jesus replied to her, the day is coming when you will neither worship here nor in Jerusalem, because that is not what is significant in terms of approaching God. The day is coming when the true worshipers of God will worship him in spirit and in truth. And she goes on to say, well, I know Messiah is coming someday. Jesus says, the one who's speaking to you is him. Jesus here, and this is, I know, part of the scandal of the claim of Christ. He claims this kind of exclusive relationship to God and as a conduit to God. He says worship will come not through Jerusalem or Samaria or anywhere else, but will come through me. And therefore, all anywhere in the world will be able to worship him. In Galatians, the 4th chapter, if I will expound this just a bit further, Paul specifically brings up this question of the relationship of Hagar and Sarah and the question of Jerusalem when he says, it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by the handmaid and one by the free woman. That is, by Hagar he had a son Ishmael, and by the free woman Sarah he had a son Isaac. Howbeit, the son by the handmaid is born after the flesh, but the son of the free woman is born through God's promise. And then Paul says, these things contain an allegory, for these women are really two covenants, one from Mount Sinai bearing children unto bondage, which he then likens to Hagar. Now this Hagar, he says, is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and answers to the Jerusalem that now is, for she is in bondage with her children. Paul does a fascinating thing here, which I know will not be received well initially by those who are Muslims or Jews. But Paul says, from our perspective, who follow the Messiah, those who are children of Hagar and those who are children of Sarah, concerned with the earthly Jerusalem, are really in the same boat together, and they are under the bondage of the law. They cannot approach unto God. They claim the law as their approach, but they violate the law, and therefore they are in bondage. He says, but the Jerusalem that is above is free, which is our mother. So Paul suggests here a different approach to the Palestinian question. He suggests that the land doesn't belong to the Jews or to the Arabs, but that was but a spiritual symbol of how God would establish his kingdom on earth, and how the real approach to God was through the Messiah. And therefore, we as Christians believe that in the end, the only way to bring peace between Jews and Muslims is going to be for both of them to recognize the claims of Christ as the Prince of Peace, who might reconcile them there. And I understand that this is not the way people are accustomed to seeing it.
well taken. But my own opinion is, if these two cultures do not find a common way, and I think that is found in Christ, if they do not find it, I don't think you ever will find an answer to the Palestinian question. The only way to get away from the Palestinian question is to get away from the question of Palestine and talk about what Palestine was a pointer to, and that's the Savior.
Okay, thank you. Now, let's go back to Sonny and have her ask another question.
I'd like to redirect one more time that question to you. I agree, and I think that anyone who spent the weekend in front of the television set watching the Clarence Thomas hearings would also agree that there is a great deal of confusion, disagreement in the Western world about sexual ethics. My question to you, though, is about sexual discrimination. And within the broad Islamic moral context that you described, and recognizing that Islam sees differences between men and women, do you think that the institutions now discriminate against women? For example, can there be a woman imam? And I'd also like to ask the same question, if I may, to Rabbi Lenz.
There can be a woman imam.
That is a religious leader in the mosque. The rabbi is very generous.
You know that the way that Jews and Muslims were living together, I remember a few years ago I attended a lecture that was given by Bernard Lewis, one of the great scholars, and he did a lot of work on Islam and the history of Arabs. And he has a famous book called The History of Arabs, Arabs in History. He was giving a lecture in one of the temples in Los Angeles, and he mentioned that in the Middle Ages, the Jews used to call their rabbis imams. So it's you have to understand the nature of a religion, the nature of a tradition. It is not think that it is not right to think that because there is a rabbi, there is a priest, and there is an imam, so it's all the three traditions look in the same way. A priest is looked in a different way in Protestant churches and then in the Catholic churches. Two have totally different views of the priest in the church. What to say about the priest, the role of the priest, and the role of the imam in the mosque and in the church? So the tradition in Islam, the point is that imam doesn't have the same kind of a role that the priest has, the clergy has in the church. Imam's role is to lead the prayer, to stand in front of the people just to organize the prayer. But he is not in any way the mediator between the people and God. He's just facilitating the organization of the prayer. So that is, one has to look at the nature of the prayer. The nature of the prayer in Islam is not that people are sitting in the chairs and somebody comes and stand up in front of them and speak or ask them to recite a hymn or bow down. The nature of prayer in Islam is very different. People stand shoulder to shoulder and the imam stands in front of them. And then they stand and they bow down and they put their forehead on the ground and it's a prostration. So there are several positions. Islam, with its whole concept of modesty and recognizing the relations that should be there between men and women, cannot put a woman in that position there, in front of the man, bowing and prostrating and having in that kind of a situation. So that's why she cannot be in that position. She can be imam of women, but she cannot be an imam in that kind of surrounding to lead the prayer, to lead the salah I'm talking about. But there have been in Islamic history, much more in the earlier times than in later times, and this is again certainly a decline, this tradition has to be revived. And that is, there have been many scholars, teachers, in fact some of the great jurists that we have in Islam, Imam Shafi'i, for example, his teacher was a woman. Prophet's own wife, Aisha. The Prophet said, seek half of your knowledge from Aisha. She but a great teacher. So an alim is much more than an imam in Islamic context. Alim is a scholar, the religious scholar, which is similar to a rabbi. Rabbi is a teacher, and alim is a teacher. And a woman can have the role of that alim. She can be a mufti. She can be even a qadi, according to some of the jurists. She can be a judge. Positions are available, but particular position of leading the prayer of a mixed gathering of male and female, that is because of the context, because of the style of the prayer, that is not given. And scholars have always said that if there is the congregation of only women, and it always happens everywhere, then whenever the women gather together in their homes or any other place, there could be a woman imam for them. So I just wanted to give you an idea that each tradition has its own organization, its own way of doing it. And one should not just put, because it happens in one thing, that must happen in another thing, and because it's not happening in the other tradition, that means the women are lower in the other tradition.
All right, Rabbi Landis, same question.
I think it's crucial for the adherents of any religion to first of all recognize the central fact of the enormous discrimination against women, and has been the truth in most of, at least Western society, I would venture to say a good deal of the world for centuries. Discrimination that has been horrifying in terms of sexual abuse, horrifying in terms of economic limitations, in terms of development and growth. Even though the potentialities of many religions are such that it doesn't necessarily have to be that way, it has been that way. And therefore, I think religion to a large degree is going to be judged in terms of how it overwhelms and overcomes much of this discrimination. You're waiting for my butt, so I'll give it to you right now. Here's the however. However is actually partial agreement with Dr. Siddiqui. And that is that religions have also other goals in mind. If it doesn't have that goal in mind, the goal I just talked about, and I think in many ways it's worthless. But it has also other goals in mind. And one of the goals it has in mind is of a sanctified existence in areas of home life, in areas of sexuality, etc. And here, we don't find a ready ally with much of the feminist movements. We just don't find a direction, don't find a little way to go. Now, within Judaism, let me say the following. Reform and conservative liberal branches of Judaism, now I believe they have no official distinction in gender roles between male and female. They have eliminated that. And they've eliminated that from a moral perspective. And I respect the experiment. I consider it an experiment because you don't know what takes place in a few years. At the same time, however, these liberal forms of Judaism are extremely weak in the adherence to the vast gamut of laws that are really part of classical Judaism, and are also experiencing great weakness in the areas of home life. That's just a fact that's statistical in terms of divorce, and in terms of the breakup of marriages, in terms of the stress and strains in this area. Orthodox Judaism is much more conservative, small c, much more conservative areas. And therefore, I think the wheel is going to grind slowly. However, I have to say one major distinction that has taken place right now. First of all, in Orthodox Judaism, the differences between men and women and the adherence to the commandments is minimal. There are a few striking differences in terms of leaving services, and in terms of who's a Jewish man or not. There are a couple of striking differences. But overall, anyone who would take any anthropological look at how Judaism is lived, there are very small differences between the two. There have been amazing gains of women in the areas of education. I expect that my daughter, and I'm fighting that my daughter should receive an equal education to any male. Therefore, will she achieve a position of teaching within the community if she so chooses? I really hope so. But it's a struggle right now. It's part of the development. Will she become the official title of a rabbi? I don't think so. Is this a goal? I'm not sure yet. I'm just not sure yet. The reason why women have been exempted from some of these areas has been the following. A rabbi is expected to be on call at all times.
A person who is supposed to be involved with some of these practices, a person who's supposed to in some way dedicate their lives more fully in this direction. There has been this gender specificity in which, even though males are required and should serve in the home, and there's great service, more service in the home, nonetheless, women who've always had outside jobs, have always had the problem of being the superwoman, because that's always been true within Judaism, nonetheless have had a special responsibility for home life. Our home life has been quite good. I'm not willing necessarily to fully experiment with this. I'm very cautious about it. So therefore, I'm curious where this is going to lead to. I don't know where it's going to lead to. I find the feminist challenge to be a true challenge, a respectful challenge. I don't find the feminist movement as a movement per se yet guideposts in all areas.
No. Dr. Amner?
I have a question for Dr. Monson now. Last night, this question will deal with the issue of a Christian view of the holiness of God that I roughly posed to Rabbi Landis. And let me preface it this way, though. Last night, Dr. Siddiqui delicately referred to Christian doctrines of